mouth.
Word of 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 mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. About 16 years ago, Jessica Leahy was a newly minted teacher who discovered that a student had lifted full paragraphs of text off the internet and put them into her school paper. Jessica called the child's mother in to tell her that she'd be initiating disciplinary action. I'll let her pick it up from here. What happened?
Well, I called the mother, and she was concerned, as any mother would be. But more than that, she was upset, and she said, you can't discipline my child. She didn't write the paper; I did, and which meant not only was she writing her daughter's paper, she was plagiarizing her daughter's work with stuff from the internet. And I'm not really sure how I'm supposed to deal with that as a teacher.
Well, now Jessica Leahy is an educator, speaker, New York Times columnist, and a contributing writer at The Atlantic. She's taking aim at the coddling, competitive helicopter parents who would do just about anything to assure their children's success and minimize their disappointments. Her new book, The Gift of Failure, How the Best Parents Learn to Let Go So Their Children Can Succeed, draws on her experience and supporting research showing that overprotective parents make for risk-averse, dependent adults. And Jessica, congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks.
Now, in the introduction, you do write, "We have taught our kids to fear failure. How?"
When I first started writing this, I was at first incensed by the overparenting and the coddling and the paving the way. But really what I became more worried about was the effect of that, the effect that kids end up really worried about making mistakes. They're worried about failing. They're worried about anything that's not perfection right off the bat, because they know that as where their parents are concerned and where colleges are concerned, every point counts. And there just isn't room to make mistakes anymore.
Well, you bring us through this historical kind of record of how children were regarded from the they should be seen and not heard in the colonial era. Then we get the parenting experts of the early 20th century and Dr. Spock in the 1950s. When did children's self-esteem become a motivating force in parenting?
Well, that came in the late 60s, early 70s, when people were working so hard to create this sort of force field of self-esteem around their kids, thinking that if we told them they were wonderful enough that, you know, any insults or injury would, you know, boing off like we had put a protective force field around them. And that's just not it's not how it works. And as many authors have shown, it didn't quite turn out that way. We've set up our kids to feel really, really confident, but not particularly competent. The confidence aspect of things doesn't have anything to do with experience. We don't let our kids have the experience to become competent. And therefore, they end up with these empty shells of, oh, well, my mommy or my daddy thinks I can do this and I'm fantastic. But there's no real experience to back that up.
So the message to kids is you're great, but you also don't know what you're doing? I mean, I don't get it.
You're brilliant, you're talented, you're wonderful, you're creative. And kids walk out into the world thinking that they shouldn't be experiencing any difficulties where these things are concerned. If they're, for example, if they're really great at math from kindergarten on, then, you know, everyone's going to come up against a place in math where it gets hard. You know, I talked with Steven Strogatz, who's a math professor at Cornell, and he says it gets hard for everybody, even, you know, a PhD in math. And so when these kids run up against those difficult moments, they then think, oh, no, I better not tell anyone. I better not show that I have any challenges here. No one's going to think that I'm smart, talented, wonderful, whatever. These labels that we put on kids of gifted, talented, brilliant, you're so wonderful all the time, are as damaging as some of the negative labels that we put on kids.
But like the mother who plagiarized for her daughter, I mean, she's well-intentioned.
Right.
She wants her to do well. And we are in this cutthroat environment, you know, pretty much from the time that kids are toddling to when they do their college SATs and applications, they are in fierce competition with each other to get placement. So it's pretty hard to drop out of that, you know, if you're just one person. Well, what kind of advice do you have to parents who think, I don't want to be in that rat race anymore? How do I do it?
I really think the best way to approach that is to think long-term instead of short-term. When we're thinking short-term about our parenting, we're thinking about making our kid happy now. We're thinking about what will help us, help for the grade tomorrow. If the kid forgets their homework, leaves it at home on the table, and I take it to them today, that will alleviate any suffering they have about the fact that they show up at school without homework today. But it doesn't do anything in terms of their long-term learning, their long-term strategies to prevent forgetting the homework the next time around.
Well, you are talking about a story with your own son, one of your own sons that you knew he'd worked really hard on this homework and he left without it and you had a struggle. Tell me about how you processed that struggle for yourself. How did you keep yourself from acting?
I was in the middle of writing this book, and I went to Facebook, and I said, lest any of you think this is easy for me, just know my kid's homework is sitting on the table right now, and he worked so hard on it. It's taking everything in me to not jump in the car with that homework. And I actually had an argument with someone on Facebook about it, but when it came down to it, I realized we had just been having a discussion about putting homework in the backpack for the past 2 weeks, actually, before that. And I knew that if I took that homework, it was going to short circuit any progress we've made towards creating a strategy to get the homework in the backpack and have it make it to school. And in the end, that was true. That day, he had to have a conversation with his teacher about strategy. And he and his teacher came up with a strategy that is something he still uses today, which is an index card on the refrigerator with a checklist of things he needs to do for the day. And that wouldn't have happened if I had taken that homework that day.
That's a lot of restraint, I think, in a case like that. But you, this is something that you talk with a parent about because you're your mother and a teacher.
Right.
So you have a couple of different perspectives on this. And there's a point where a mother comes to you and she says that her daughter just doesn't seem excited about learning anymore. And you say the less we push our kids towards educational success, the more they will learn. Now, how do you back that up?
I back that up with the research on intrinsic motivation. The fantastic and brilliant Edward Deci wrote a book called Why We Do What We Do, The Science of Human Motivation. And for us to find our own interest in what we're doing, for us to find flow, that wonderful thing that Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi talks about, flow, where we're engaged in an activity just for the activity itself, not for some end result we're hoping to get out the other side of it. We have to be autonomous, we have to feel competent, and we have to feel connected both to the activity and to the people around us and know that whatever it is we're doing means something to the world around us. And when we're acting only out of an interest in points, grades, in order to make our mom happy, in order to get approval, that's not where true motivation, where intrinsic motivation comes from. That's not how we achieve real flow with whatever it is we're doing. We can't get there when we're extrinsically motivated, either by our parents or grades or teachers or whatever. And the more I saw my students pushed to do things for the product and not for the process, the more I saw them lose interest in the process. Mm-hmm. And for a teacher, that's a disaster.
We're speaking with Jessica Leahy. She writes the Parent-Teacher Conference column for the New York Times, and she's an educator and speaker and now author of The Gift of Failure, How the Best Parents Learn to Let Go So Their Children Can Succeed. Well, that research also built upon some research earlier about rewards. Now, mm-hmm. you're against this. You say ditch the lollipop in your book, against that sort of system of rewards. Tell us more about what is behind that thinking and how we can break ourselves from this. You know, everyone gets a ribbon, even if you're in 13th place.
Right. Anyone who's read Dan Pink's Drive, this will not be news to them. Dan Pink really did an incredible job looking at the science of rewards based on the work of Harry Harlow and Edward Deci. And he talked about it mostly from a business perspective, also a little bit from an education perspective. And there's a great point to be made that, you know, when the seal trainer runs out of herring, the seal show is over. The sea lions don't act anymore when the herring is gone. And something about when we give kids, when we give primates, in the case of Harry Harlow, when we gave them rewards, their interest in doing the thing, the the trick, the whatever the activity was, in doing the thing for the thing itself declined. Rewards seem to mess not only with motivation, but also with creativity.
So one of the suggestions is have kids help out with household chores. Now, why household chores? What does that do for them?
Well, the bigger picture really is to have goals. One of the things that parents ask me a lot about is, okay, well, this is all well and good, but we still have to deal with test scores. We still have to deal with grades. We still have to deal with things like that. And I say, well, let's make home a place where we're more oriented on process instead of product, and we're more oriented towards personal goals. We talk about it a lot in our family, you know, making goals that employ some sort of risk. And one of the things that people tend to focus on when they talk about goals or they talk about rewards is getting money for chores. And that's something that just doesn't seem to work. If you read a book like The Opposite of Spoiled by Ron Lieber, he talks about that in his book as well. And there's something about being a part of a team, being a part of a family, being part of a class that seems to foster motivation. And in our household, we do things for each other and we do things for our household because they're part of our responsibility, not because we're going to get paid for them.
Yeah, but you talk about your inner monologue. What's going on there? It's faster if I just do it by myself. You know, it's going to take so much to teach him. People are going to judge me. My house is going to look terrible. You know, my kids are going to look terrible if they're not if they're dressing themselves in whatever is on the bed or whatever.
Well, I have two stories from this week. There was crusty dishes that came out of our dishwasher, and those had to be redone, and it led to yet another discussion about why the crusty food was on the plate in the first place. And then we had a load of laundry that had to get done twice in our house because it sat in the dryer all night long, and my husband even tweeted out a lovely picture of my older son sitting next to a pile of laundry on the couch because he was steadfastly avoiding folding it. It's not a process of, okay, I change the way things work in my house and overnight we have success. It's a long-term goals are sort of the name of the game here. My kids have learned how to do stuff and then in that wonderful way teenagers tend to do it, have forgotten how to do laundry or forgotten how to load the dishwasher the right way and have gone to school wearing disgusting dirty clothes or mismatched outfits. But that's all part of this wonderful process of growing up, and far be it from me to remove those moments for them.
Well, you mentioned the moment of risk. How do you distinguish what are the great learning experiences and what is something that could, you know, lead them down the wrong path? I mean, it's, of course, not one action is going to be so deterministic, but what's the right way to point?
I think the hard part is sometimes it's hard to know which moments are going to be going down the wrong path and which moments are going to be great learning experiences until you've seen them out. And I think we've gotten into this trap where we're so worried that every single failure is going to lead to some long-term, this is going to go on your permanent record sort of moment, that we're really afraid to take the leap and take the risk with our kid. And there's a story in the book about a mom whose son really was failing out of school, and the school had decided it was time for him to leave that school and go back to his school district school that was far inferior to the school he'd been attending. And the mother came to him and said, look, we're going to go visit that other school and you're going to have some hard decisions to make. Either you engage or I'm going to let you fail out of this superior school and you're going to have to go back to this other school where you're not going to get as much individual attention. And the son, when faced with that decision and when faced with both realities, made the decision to take control of his own work and his own motivation. And it was a real life-changing decision for him. If she had taken over and written his essays for him or taken over and reminded him every single day to put his homework in his bag, he may still be at that superior school, but he wouldn't have learned anything. And he certainly wouldn't have changed in the huge way that his mother reports he has changed since then.
Well, it takes a huge change in parenting. And I wonder if that is something, you know, when you're looking at the long view, someone can read this book and what kind of small incremental changes you might begin.
Right. There's another story where someone was really upset with me for giving her daughter a B-. And I said in our discussion in our parent-teacher conference that was called with myself and my boss and both parents, and it was all very serious because of this B-. And I said at one point, I said, you're going to have to trust me. This B- is going to be one of the best things that ever happened to your daughter. They didn't. In the end, that girl wrote about that B- as being a really important point in her middle school career, a moment when she realized she had to make some decisions about what she valued in herself, the hard work versus the coasting. And, you know, in the end, those parents, you know, if they were to have another crisis with their child, who knows if they're going to remember that moment, but their daughter will. And that's what's important to me.
Well, Jessica Leahy, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Jessica Leahy is a contributing writer for The New York Times and for The Atlantic. She's author of a new book that's coming out next week. It's called The Gift of Failure, How the Best Parents Learn to Let Go So Their Children Can Succeed. And before coming out, it has already been named one of Amazon's best books of the month. There's more in the book at wordofmouthradio.org.